Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Toni Jordan. I'm a Melbourne-based novelist, and it's my great pleasure to welcome all of you to the Melbourne Writers Festival podcast. Today, I'm here on the beautiful unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and they've been telling stories here for tens of thousands of years. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. In this podcast, I'll be speaking with two debut novelists about their wonderful new books. Let me introduce them to you. Jacqueline Maley is an award-winning journalist and columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Her debut novel is called The Truth About Her. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you, Toni. Thank you for having me.
And also joining us, Philip Vickershin is a Melbourne doctor who works in a range of positions in sexual health, cosmetic medicine, and general practice. His first novel is called Modern Marriage. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honour.
Well, I'd like to start by talking about the two of you. Writing and publishing a debut novel is such an enormous achievement. It's so time-consuming. It's so difficult to organise, especially when you have a day job in a busy field that doesn't necessarily align. And it's even more of an achievement when the novels are as outstanding as these two are. I'm going to start with you, Jacqueline. Your day job is a journalist, so what made you want to write fiction?
Well, I think I always wanted to write fiction, and I think that in a way that's why I got into journalism, because it was sort of a semi-respectable way to write for a living where I could also earn an income, which isn't really the case with novel writing, unless you're very lucky. So I think that I'd always been writing sort of creatively on the side, and I'd always wanted to write a book. And I suppose I was like a lot of journalists in that respect, because a lot of journalists think that, you know, they've got a secret novelist harbored within them, and, you know, maybe an unfinished manuscript in the top drawer. And I'd been like that for a while, but I just really wanted to get it done. So I did. And, you know, in a way, there were some synergies, to use that word, between novel writing and journalism, because I was quite good at just punching out copy, and I wasn't particularly fussy or sort of precious about the writing process, because as a journalist, obviously you can't afford to be. So that helped me get words on the page, and then hopefully I, you know, was able to go over them at a later stage and make them a little bit more beautiful than they might have been in the first draft. But, yeah, so it did help having that journalism background in terms of just churning out, like, words.
But there must have been things you had to unlearn as well. I mean, there must have been, you know, journalists are looking for a story, and with a novel, really, it's all about the journey of getting to the answer rather than giving people the details up front. Like, what are the things you had to change about the way you wrote?
Yeah, well, Catherine Milne, who ended up publishing the book, looked at it very early on, and she was encouraging, but she was like, you know, you can slow down. Like, you can just take your time.
We don't have a deadline. Yeah. You've got like 1,500 words or whatever to get it all down.
Yeah, you've got plenty of time to breathe. You know, you've got sort of 90,000 words where you can tell this story. So I think that was one thing. Like, the pacing is just obviously a much slower in a novel, so it took me a while to work out how to do that. And also, it sounds funny, but just being able to completely untrammel myself from any tyranny of facts or sort of, you know, objective truth, if you know what I mean. So for a while I was sort of writing with this, I don't know, like this sort of presence on my shoulder, which was like, that's not realistic, or that's not right, or that's not, you know, that would never I don't know, like just thinking about facts in the way that a journalist would. And then once I sort of made that psychological leap where I was like, well, novelists can make up anything they want, and all that matters is that it's true within the context of the story that you're telling. And as long as you make it seem true or make it seem feasible, your readers really will accept anything. So that once I sort of made that leap, it was really freeing, because I was like, wow, you know, I can just make up so much stuff. Like, that's actually what I'm trying to do here. Whereas in journalism, it's frowned upon to make
up. Well, it is kind of frown upon it. And I was expecting you to say kind of the opposite thing, that you know, your first allegiance is to the truth. So this was, you know, a bit more of a stretch. I wasn't expecting you to say that it was kind of a relief to chill back and make stuff up.
No, I'm not sure that what that says about my journalism. They'll probably give my critics sort of great fodder. No, I mean, I think, you know, there's so many stories in the news that you just think, God, there's got to be such a good story behind that. And long-form journalism can do a really good job of telling the story in a narrative sense and sort of portraying some of the characters who might be involved in a news story. So I guess throughout my career I've just always, you know, just sponged all of that up and just thought, wow, wouldn't it be interesting to sort of explore some of the problems and dilemmas and conflicts and dramas that you read in the news in a sort of more novelistic sense. So a lot of novelists do that, of course, and I'm just maybe, you know, one of the latest to try it. But yeah, I guess I was sort of both inspired and by my journalism and also had to reject it in another way.
Philip Percussion, can I just ask you the same question? I mean, a GP with a young family. We were just talking before about you had a number of small children, and you're a, well, not a GP actually, are you? You do medical medicine.
I do kind of everything. Yeah, the true generalist.
So how does that work out? I mean, I understand there's a long history of doctor writers that go all the way back to Chekhov, but how do you just wake up one day and go, I'm just going to write a novel now?
So a little bit differently to Jacqueline, and I'm so impressed with her book as well. I loved her book. For me, it was more a case of escape. I was finding that I was spending a lot of my free time doom scrolling and reading too much news.
Sorry, Jacqueline. Not sorry.
I have total sympathy.
And it was kind of getting me down, to be honest. This was, you know, war and Trump tweets and or just constant. And now it's even, I think, even more with COVID. And for me, it was a way of escaping. So I really enjoyed reading. I enjoyed writing back at school, but when I got into medicine and the sciences, I kind of veered away from that. And I just decided to use my time productively. And so I enrolled in in an online writing course and a in-person writing course at Writers Victoria, just for something to do. And then I spent my lunch breaks writing on my phone, and that was my escape. And that was my way of digesting the day and just escaping and trying to be creative and trying to create something as opposed to just constantly absorbing and taking in particularly negative stuff. And I found that it was a really, really good meditation and a good way of doing that, because I would just leave my consulting room and get on my phone and have a coffee and write. So that was the impetus.
Well, Jacqueline mentioned, you know, she had early readers and she had the skills of being a writer. Was it easier for you? The fact that I'm assuming that no one was waiting for this book. You didn't have like a friend in publishing who was cheering you on. Did that make it easier or harder?
I think it was probably easier. I think probably with Jacqueline, you know, she is a writer. She's, you know, producing a lot of information. I think for me, I never intended to get a book published, honestly. I just wanted to do something that was for me and in a vacuum. So it was easy. It really was. It was just a thrill. It was so much fun. I couldn't wait to leave my room, my consulting room, open up Google Docs and just be like, what am I going to write today? I could write anything. I could do anything I want, you know. So it was easy and I had no expectations at all.
But there must have been one point where you look back and you go, actually, you know, this is okay. What do I do with this now? How was that decision where it moved from being a private thing that you did for your own amusement into the possibility of something else?
I think when I hit maybe 40,000 words, I was like, I wonder how many words are in a book, you know, like, because I mean, I read a lot, but how many actually words are there? And then I was like, oh, you know, maybe this could end up somewhere. And my husband's very supportive, you know, he kept on supporting me. And then I did more online courses. And I guess, you know, looking back on it now, I think maybe I probably did want to write a book. I think maybe a lot of people do, but I maybe didn't want to truly admit it to myself. So only after I had a first draft did I then go back and in the meantime, I was listening to a lot of podcasts, actually, a lot of book podcasts, writing podcasts. And I guess that was all kind of exerting its effect on me. And then I kind of got my husband to read it. I was kind of one step at a time. I'm kind of one of those people that don't want to be too aspirational. I'm kind of like, just do your own little journey on your own and don't tell anyone. And just,
well, he must have been stunned. He must have picked it up and read it and just been stunned with it.
Yeah. It wasn't great at the start, obviously. Oh. It had a lot of editing. but yeah, he's very proud.
But like the fact that Jacqueline had some lessons in fiction to learn, I always think that doctors have a particularly good ear for narrative, because what they're doing when they diagnose somebody is listening to their stories and trying to make sense of that story. Do you think that was helpful for you?
Absolutely. And you're right. I mean, I actually do a lot of writing. You know, patients will often maybe, you know, come in for a half an hour appointment, and I will pick what I've write down in their notes, the pertinent stuff that gives a flow of information. So I think that's a really, really good point.
I'd like to talk about the books themselves now for a little bit. And I'm going to start with you, Jacqueline. The title of this podcast is Scandalous Fictions. And I think that's a very apt title for both those books. The Truth About Her is the story of Susie, who's an award-winning journalist and a single mother. And she's very good at her job. And she publishes a clever expose of a fake health blogger. Like, this is a kind of ripped from the headline story about someone who has alleged that she cured herself of cancer, and maybe that isn't quite the case. And then Susie's career kind of dramatically unravels when she wakes up one morning to find the health blogger has killed herself. I mean, that's a very believable thing to happen. Where did that first germ of an idea come from for you?
I was thinking a lot about consequences, and I was thinking about shame and sort of public shaming, I suppose, in the context of social media, but also more generally. And I think I've always held in my mind as a journalist the sort of tension between what we do in our jobs, like the best measure of a great story sometimes is a career ruined or a life ruined, to be honest. I mean, not that you set out to do that, but, you know, having someone stripped of their position, for example, can be a sort of almost like a KPI for a journalist. So there's this tension, and it's very sort of ethically grey between the best journalism being sort of the worst for, you know, the best public interest journalism being the worst thing for individual lives. And against that, I suppose, a more novelistic treatment of the nuances and the subtleties and the complexities of dilemmas and dramas and wrongdoing that, you know, that you read about in the news. So I'd always sort of thought about that tension, and I thought it would be really interesting to explore in a novelistic context. And then, I don't know, I was just sort of thinking about consequences, and I thought, you know, what's the worst consequence that a story could possibly have? And that was what I came up with. And as soon as I had that idea, I just thought it was really, really ripe with so much possibility. So, and I really wanted to explore it and put characters on either side of it. And I've since discovered that it did actually happen to a journalist who wrote a story in the 1990s. Yeah. So it happened to a journalist who wrote a magazine piece about a guy who was sort of, who was a finance guy. And so it was sort of, you know, a dreadful thing, which I didn't realize at the time. I had no idea, but I just thought it would be really, really interesting premise for a book. And once I had that idea, I explored it.
I'm fascinated also by, it's not a very long time period in Susie's life that you cover. It's a matter of, you know, some months, but it's kind of a nexus of a lot of things that go wrong, because she also gets in trouble for sleeping with someone she shouldn't be sleeping with. Her daughter is ill. There's a lot of kind of load on her that, yes, single mothers are constantly under, but everything just seems to go wrong for her at the wrong time together.
Yeah, well, that's another thing I just had a really firm idea about before I started the book, that it would be the story of, yeah, that everything would go wrong, or the whole sort of the protagonist's life would unravel at the beginning of it, and then the rest of it would be the sort of fallout and sort of reconciliation story, I suppose. So, yeah, I did do that, and I kind of kept, you know, I kept ploughing more and more disaster upon her head, which, you know, you sort of have to do as a novelist to your poor old protagonist. But it was also the pressure that she was under. I wanted that to be very, very present and sort of atmospheric in the book, because I do think that, you know, that's a sort of reasonably realistic representation of what it's like to be a single parent, that it sometimes feels like, you know, it's wave after wave of stress and disaster, particularly when, you know, there's a passage when I describe all the illnesses, and I'm sure Philip will be well across this, but yeah, I just remember that being like, you know, it was like you'd come up for a breath and you'd like suck air into your lungs, you know, and then another gastro would hit you, or another adenovirus or some hideous medieval thing that you'd never heard of before and you didn't think was still bacterially possible. Yeah, so I just wanted to I did want to sort of create a lot of stress for my main character.
And the characters are also perfect, but I really must talk about Susie's daughter, Maddie, because she's a very young child, but it's just pitch perfect. Like, I rarely find children that perfectly drawn in fiction. Was she difficult to write?
Yes and no, because I'm the same as you. I think it is so hard to get the voice of a child, strangely enough, integrated into a novel well. Some people do it fantastically. I think some of the best novelists are actually the ones who write from the point of view of children or young people, and I just think that's a feat that I wouldn't even dare attempt. But yeah, so it was hard, but it was also my daughter was around the same age at the time. So a lot of the stuff, or some of the stuff that's in it, is a very, you know, sort of taken from her, or even like the things that I observed just spending a lot of time with small children at that time in my life. And it was something that I just really had thought doesn't often get a very sort of good novelistic or literary treatment, the experience, the in the trenches experience of being the parent of a really small child.
But she's an actual character in herself, Maddie. She's not just there to show Susie as a parent.
No.
Like, she's a well-formed little person with her own kind of drivers, which, yeah, I don't see that very often.
Yeah, and I think I don't know if this is because I suppose most novels historically have been written by men, and they're not always good at getting, I don't know, maybe they haven't always been particularly good at realizing their child characters as fully formed, fully fledged human beings. But I mean, you'll know, and you know, Philip was just saying he's got 13-week-old twins, like their personality is so manifest from when they're tiny. And if you spend any time around them, you quickly do away with any illusions that you're sort of somehow molding and forming their, you know, their personality. Yeah. It's just like, no, you were fully formed before I even met you. Like,
totally.
You know.
Thank you for that. Philip, Scandalous Fiction for you is also a very apt title for modern marriage. It's your protagonist is a cosmetic doctor, Clara. And she has a really terrible event happen to her. Her husband, Dante, whom she adores, they haven't been married for that long, collapses and is placed in a coma. And from the beginning of the book, this isn't a spoiler, from the beginning of the book, we're aware that he's unlikely to recover. Clara absolutely adores him. So you would think that this horrible thing would be the worst thing that could possibly happen to a young woman. But it turns out that she might not have known Dante as well as she thought. This is a really, it's a high concept kind of story where you started with this, the story starts with this enormous shock. So where did that idea come from?
The idea was originally seeded by a colleague of mine who told me of a friend of a friend in another state who managed a similar case, actually, of a man who was found unconscious in a gay sauna. And so that was that when I heard that just lodged in my brain. I'd heard of cases of that happen before, actually, in the news. and then when I heard of it closer to someone in real life, I just thought, wow, like, what a place to be found And imagine if he was married, and imagine if his wife found out that that's where he was, and all these imagine if that, this, imagine if that. And it just stuck in my brain for about a year. And that was the year of the plebiscite, when all we talked about was gay marriage. And I just thought, God, imagine if this plebiscite was 10 years ago, would this even be in my mind? Would I even be thinking about this? You know, it was just so heightened that year. So that was the seed of the story. And then, like Jacqueline said, you know, I pile it on her in the story. And pile it on.
Sure does. Poor Clara has everything going wrong. And just like Jacqueline, some of the minor characters, well, they're not so minor, but they're just drawn so exquisitely. So my attention was fixed on Rachel, who is Clara's sister-in-law, married to one of Dante's brothers. They come from a close family. And, you know, we all know people like a Rachel in our lives, and perhaps we all wish we didn't.
Absolutely, absolutely. Rachel is an amalgam of that kind of God complex savior, health professional who doles out advice when you don't really want to hear it, and has good intentions, but you know the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as they say. She's self-serving as well, but you know, aren't we all? Don't we all go overseas to volunteer really for ourselves, kind of thing? You know, I guess I'm examining that. Both those things. I think I've been Rachel at one point in my life. A lot of my colleagues have been Rachel at one point in their life. She's a good person to dislike as well.
There's also, as well as the timing of the plebiscite, which is fantastic, Clara's best friend is gay and is looking forward to marriage with his partner. And that's a very exciting kind of time for them as they're planning, you know, how this wedding is going to come through. And you're also left with the kind of underlying idea. I have to confess, I've told you both already, but I've not read either ending of either book, because for a start, I'm personally petrified that I'll give away like something exciting. I hate people who give away the ending better than I don't know, but I'm just dying to get back to them. I'm dying to know was the big thing when Susie made her split up with her husband, and I'm dying to know whether Dante is actually like fully closeted, whether he was experimenting, what exactly was going through his mind. So there's kind of both of these books have this enormous secret that you're making me gripping me right to the very end. So we don't, at the stage that I'm at, which is just short of the end, we don't know exactly what was going through Dante's mind in this place. So how did you manage to construct a character who we really don't actually meet in this story, but he's the pivot around which everything else moves?
Yeah, I loved the idea of, as I was writing it, I was thinking, should he be in it more or not? And I just love the idea of that absence and all the stories that we make to fill in those absences when we can't get the information that we so want and need, and where our minds go with that, you know, because we can interpret situation in three people can have 20 different opinions of what has actually happened. And I just love that as a mechanism, really.
I'm guessing that there wasn't a whole lot of research that you needed to do, because you are already a cosmetic doctor. So all that stuff, all that, the medical stuff, which is so fascinating about the injections and the, like, all that, you knew all that already?
Yeah,
you didn't have to do much?
Yeah, no, because I do the fillers and Botox and that kind of stuff, and I work in GP land and I work in sexual health, so a lot of the stuff is drawn on my, I think it's a lot of my processing of, you know, cases I've seen, patients I've seen, the way that I've reacted to certain stressful events, and I guess just my own life as well. Yeah, it's all kind of imbued in there.
Jacqueline, did you have to do a lot of research to put yourself in the mind of Susie? I mean, I know she's a journalist just like you are, but was there other things you had to find out about the book?
I did little bits and pieces of research. I mean, as you noted earlier, the story of Tracy Doran, the wellness blogger, was sort of based on, well, it was, I wouldn't say it was based on, but the idea for it was definitely came from the news. And I think you know the case that we're talking about. So early on, I did a bit of reading about that case. But then I actually decided there was a book that was written by a couple of AIDS journalists, I think, about that case. And I was, you know, hovering, deciding whether or not to buy it and read it. But then I didn't do that because I wanted to make it my own story. I didn't want it to be the story of. I just wanted to basically use, just sort of shamelessly use the premise with, while also creating my own character. Yeah, so that was the main bit of research that I did. I'm trying to remember what else I would have done. I think that was pretty much it. I mean, rather than research, I think I just did a lot of reading. And because I hadn't written a novel, you know, it was I thought a lot about structure and narrative. So I never felt like I had a lot of problems. The problems that I have had with writing, or the difficulties I had with writing, were not so much the writing itself, but the structure and the narrative and how to pace it and, you know, the little bit of plotting that I used to do. So I didn't consider it a really plot-heavy novel, but I knew that I had to have some sort of plot. So I actually did a lot of, like, reading about plot and how writers structure plot. And I went back to all of my favorite books and I used to look at really technical stuff. So how does this novelist move this person through time and space? And how have they done this transition from this bit to this bit? And what's the timestamp? You know, stuff like how long is the timestamp? How long is the time span of the book? And are we using a flashback? You know, all of that stuff that is so seamless when you read it. And I just went back and I sort of had to study it like I was a human being who was learning English for the first time, you know. I really pored over the books that I think are sort of masterful to see how they accomplish
it. That's the best way to learn, don't you both think? Like, you've got to kind of lift up the hood on an existing novel and look at it not from the driver's seat, like from someone who's just reading it for the fun of it. You've got to actually lift up the hood and say, how does this thing work? Does the mechanics of this actually work?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I loved about, you know, the novel writing process. And Philip was, you know, you were talking before about Philip's character, Dante, who you never meet and is constructed through really the reporting of the other characters in the book. And so it's all, and, you know, reported speech and all that kind of stuff. And that I find really interesting, how little, you know, novelists tell you. So some novels you go back to and you think you've got such a strong impression of a character, like, you know, like Gene Brody, you know, like all, there's so many examples. And when you actually go back to the book, unless you're reading like George Eliot, they're not giving you a huge amount of information about the character. They're not always giving you backstory and, you know, their life story and buckets of information. It can just be much more impressionistic than that. And sometimes you get the sense of a character from the way they speak or the way they move. You know, I just found all that stuff really, really interesting and tried to copy the best bits of it that I could.
You both do this to some degree. Like Philip, you get an idea that Clara is not in love with herself. Like, she's filled with some degree of, I don't want to say self-loathing, that might be a bit strong, but she's really not comfortable with herself. And it's quite a long way into the book where another character says, but she's so beautiful. And because you've been mostly in her view, you haven't realized that she's beautiful. She doesn't see herself as beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And very similarly with Susie, she kind of doesn't even really think about her physicality very much at all. She feels kind of older and she feels exhausted as a mother. And it's not until kind of her on-off boyfriend takes a photo of her that he keeps for himself that you get to see how beautiful she is in his eyes. Mm. So both of you do that, kind of partially construct these characters from the view of other people. And I found that fascinating in both of your works. Is that something you did, Jacqueline? Is that something you did consciously?
Yeah, I did, because the whole book, if it has a theme, is about the stories that we tell ourselves about our own lives and the stories that we tell about other people, and the way that it's really the only way we have to construct truth, whatever that means. But it's also incredibly imperfect because stories vary according to the teller. So that idea was sort of shot through the book. And certainly, yeah, Susie's boyfriend, Tom, who's a photographer, he doesn't tell stories. He tells stories, you know, through that visual visual means. And Susie is sort of struck, yeah, at that moment in the book with how he's presented to her a version of herself that she didn't know existed because he's seeing her through his eyes. And you might even say that's what, you know, that's what love is, or that's what love can do. So that's what I was sort of trying to do with that whole thing.
I have now one final question to each of you, and I'm going to start with you, Jacqueline, again. I felt your story was overall kind of about redemption, because Susie kind of discovers this way, I don't want to give too much away because it's so thrilling, discovers this way to kind of redeem herself by seeing the blogger as a whole person. And by this process of seeing somebody as a whole person instead of just the con artist sort of slice that she's seen in the past, she kind of reveals, discovers herself as a whole person. What do you think about that idea of redemption?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to do that because I was really interested in the idea of all the wrongs that human beings do to each other. And, you know, there is an element of sort of social media that's in the book, or that's sort of probably maybe one of the themes explored in the book. And the problem with social media shaming and, you know, cancelling, as we call it, is that it doesn't leave much room for redemption, because there's never really a good way to say sorry. If you're at the subject of a cancellation, it seems to me, that just seems to me to be robbing all of us of some sort of humanity, because if we don't believe that people can change, we don't have a lot to work with. And also the concept of characters changing is really at the heart of all good fiction, right? Even if the changes are very small or incremental. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to do that. And part of, I think, change and redemption is being sort of self-critical or admitting fault and responsibility, which is also something that human beings don't tend to be very good at in my experience. You know, nobody is, none of us is. I was trying to do all that, definitely.
Well, you've done that beautifully in The Truth About Her. It's just a gorgeous story. Thank you. And my last question for you, Philip, I felt that your story was kind of at its heart a journey of discovery. You know, Clara thinks she's a very capable woman with, as you say, a modern marriage. And as the story progresses, she kind of realizes how little she knows about herself and the people around her. So from this enormous shock to the system at the beginning of the book, she goes through a very hard time where she feels like she can hardly recognize herself. And that manifests in her body. And it also ties in with the work that she does, which is to change people's physical appearances. How does that idea of a journey of discovery kind of sit with you?
Yeah, I think that's a really good description, really. I think a lot of this genesis of this book was my own discovery of myself, and also the assumptions that I sometimes make of patients when they come through the door, and you think that they look like one thing and then they tell you something completely different. And I think that's just humans. You know, we do that for all manner of reasons. And I guess the beauty of writing a book is getting to peel those layers behind and peeking through and trying to, like Jacqueline said, get to some kind of truth, because we all have different truths. and trying to discover them, you know, and whatever your truth is right now might be different either in the future or the way that it's perceived by someone else. So I think discovery is a really good way of putting it.
Well, I'm so thrilled to have had the opportunity to read both of those marvellous books. I'm going to just log off for the afternoon and finish the ending of them both. I can hardly wait. That's my little treat for the day. And that's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank Jacqueline Maley and Philip Fukushin for being my guests today. You can buy The Truth About Her and Modern Marriage from the Melbourne Writers Festival Partner Bookshop Readings. Thank you so much for listening and for supporting the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.